Welcome to this second public event in the Cultures of Consumption Research Program. I'm Frank Trentman, the director of the program. One purpose of the Cultures of Consumption Program is to provide a space for shared public and academic discussion. And our speaker today is a personal embodiment of this spirit. Tim Lang is professor of food policy at City University, has been a researcher, campaigner, and consultant locally, nationally, and internationally. Amongst many other things, he's chairman of Sustain, and together with Yanis Gabriel, author of the influential The Unmanageable Consumer, which will come out in a new updated edition next year. This evening, Tim will talk about Food Wars, the modern drama of consumer sovereignty. Food is an important strand in the Culture of Consumption research program, and so I'm particularly delighted that our first comment this evening will come from one of my colleagues in the program, Professor Peter Jackson of the University of Sheffield, who is directing a very original project on the food chain. We're also very pleased to have Lord Haskins with us this evening. Chris Haskins, as you will know, has just completed his review of rural delivery for the government, and obviously previously was chairman of Northern Foods. After two comments from these gentlemen, there will be time for questions from the floor and discussion. And then afterwards, we'll have a reception downstairs in the dining room where we can continue discussion, and you'll also have an opportunity to meet some of the other researchers in the program. I now welcome Tim to guide us safely across the battlefields of food wars, the modern drama of consumer sovereignty. Tim.
Thanks very much, Frank.
They're not escaping already, they're just doing it so they can see the slides. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for those kind words, Frank. I had a very hard task. I'm someone like many of us here who's very used to public speaking and doing lectures on a variety of things. But this was very difficult. Firstly, among my peer group, among people who work in food, and nothing could be more vibrant than food at the moment. So I set out to try to straddle, is the best way to describe it, three sort of areas. One is the issue of, I think, some real problems about modern consumption and consumerism and what it is to be a consumer, with the realities of the food supply chain, which I think are very amazingly important and also very good terrain on which to explore some of these problems. And thirdly, because it's my day job, try to come up with some pointers about policy and the frameworks that I think might help us make sense of this very complex area. I've got a lot of slides to show you, so I'm going to whiz through these. But you can either sit back and relax, as I used to say when I was a lumpen polytechnic lecturer, and watch the pigs fly past. Or you can ask me for a copy of them, which if you give me an email, I'll email them to you. But there is going to be a written paper, which is almost complete, which I think is going to be available through Frank and the program. Being lumpen polytechnic trained, always tell your victims what you're going to say. That in one slide is what I'm going to say. I'm not going to read it out. You can read, I hope. Essentially, it's the bit at the bottom that interests me, which is that I'm going to give you some examples of how I think we can make sense of this complex area of food and the battles around it. And I'm not a particularly sort of militaristic-oriented person. We've just been through a war, a rather bizarre war. President Bush is coming tomorrow to remind us of all of the idiocy of that war. But the title that Frank gave me was actually drawn from a book that one of my colleagues, Mike Heisman, and I have written, which is going to come out very early next year, and it's called Food Wars. And it's essentially about the battle of paradigms. It's saying that we can't really understand what's going on in food, because we've got a framework of thinking about food which is now no longer appropriate. The key questions I want to address, and I'm trying to address consumers at the heart of it, is what shapes food consumption? How powerful are consumers? I'm actually going to be gently quite critical. I'm going to say that the rhetoric about consumer sovereignty is nonsense. I think we've got to prick this bubble. The reality in food is a very, very stark power inequality and power imbalance, and we've got to rethink it. I'm going to be asking questions about what drives the food system. I'm probably going to deeply offend Chris. We usually offend each other in a very genteel way. We always get on very well. But I'm probably going to be immensely crude, seen through the eyes of a chief exec of a very large company. And I'm then going to ask questions about public policy. And in fact, I'm going to argue that what we call public policy is itself needing to be reframed. We've got to stop thinking about public policy as something the state does, and we've got to start thinking about it as itself a battleground between a triangle of the state, the food supply chain, the companies that drive it, and civil society. And this in one slide is the food wars thesis. This is a very arrogant run through 250 years, forgive the crudity, 1800 to 2050, we're here, 2000. Essentially, for the last 50 years, arguably 60 or 70 years, we've had in place what we call the productionist paradigm, which I will explain in a moment, which drew upon astonishing revolutions in agriculture, plant breeding, animal breeding, etc. The industrialization of food that went on. When you had industry, you had to provide food for people. Steel mills for grinding flour, for example, came in the mid to late 19th century. The chemical revolution, clearly. The transport revolution, above all. You could not get the productionist paradigm without both the ships we've got here, but also in particular the canals, actually, that preceded it. The price of wheat, for example, quartered when the canals went in Staffordshire in the late 18th century. And we're in now the era of food wars, where all of the issues about how to capture the consumer, what vision for the consumer, what sort of food business will serve the consumer, who controls the food supply. And arguably, Mike Heisman and I argue, from this is emerging two very distinct choices of paradigm. One we call the life sciences integrated paradigm, a reductionist paradigm, and the other is an ecologically integrated paradigm. Here is the productionist paradigm. Crudely, it went linear like this. You will deliver human health or public goods, doesn't matter which they are, by investing in science and technology, in other words, investing capital in these three areas, agriculture to processing to distribution, and then you will deliver consumer choice and human health, drawing upon, clearly, nature. From about the 1970s, as this productionist paradigm that was put in place in the 1950s, in our case by the 1947 Agriculture Act in Britain, but throughout the world, it was a model that was rolled out by Lord Boydor, the first Director General of the Food and Agriculture Organization. Essentially, when it became, the evidence already was beginning to mount up, it wasn't working, there were problems about health, about environment, bolt-on bits happened. Health education basically began to be invested in the 1970s. Here is the life sciences. It's a circular model. Drawing upon genetic inheritance, normal cell growth, we are now moving towards pharmacogenetics. In other words, targeting what franks, predisposition to diseases, and then doing predisposition testing, personalized medicine, working out the nutrients in a mutually reinforcing cycle with consumer choice, altering metabolism to alter gene expression, and don't let's forget physical activity. And the role of the food supply chain comes up here. A very different model is emerging from the ecologically integrated paradigm, which says human environmental health is fundamental to what the food supply chain does. It is a circular relationship, it goes round, and it is essentially drawing upon food culture, social capital, and genetic inheritance. It's a different way. It's saying everything has to address and be built upon human and environmental health. It's a different way. Now, let's get to the real heart of it. I've got six key points that I'm going to make. The first feature we have to appreciate is the rapidity and the pace and the scale of change and their consequences. I am going to be very fast. Just read this. Worldwide, there is this happening. In particular, I'm going to focus upon the nutrition transition, but I'm also, in honour of Frank and the ESRC AHRB Cultures of Consumption Programme, which I'm very happily on the advisory board to, I'm going to focus on that. So I'm not going to talk so much about epidemiology or demographic, but these four transitions is what we often call globalisation. Astonishing shift is occurring. The productionist paradigm was put in place to resolve a view that the problem of health was under supply, under consumption. And if we increase production, the problems would be resolved. That is no longer the case. We now have, and I'm going to give you some data, massive increase of burden from crudely overproduction, oversupply, maldistribution, malconsumption. In the nutrition transition, we broadly are doing this. We're consuming more of meat, etc., energy density, less of the staples, fruit and vegetables, fibre and water, that we know epidemiologically will deliver health. The factors that drive this transition are these. You know this, much talked about now. This issue, the marketing I'm going to focus on. And here in one slide, forgive me, anyone who's seen me show this. This is from the great Barry Popkin, University of North Carolina, whose phrase the nutrition transition is. Here on the left axis, we've got annual income per person per year, $200 US up to $10,000 US. We're way up here per person, okay? What happens as people get richer is they eat more animal fat. This is physiologically given. It was very useful a million years ago when our physiology was laid down. Astonishingly important to realise that now the supply chain is no longer in flunter, as we say up north, with our bodies. And this is an example. Look at the explosion of meat consumption that's going on. As the productionist revolution has been efficient and effective, so it has delivered these yields. But what it has done is create problems of non-communicable diseases. Forgive the language if you're not familiar with it. That means things like heart disease, diet-related cancers, diabetes, strokes, etc., etc. This is now the majority of the world. This is global figures. Okay, 55,694 people died in the year 2000 worldwide, and that's what they died from. If we look at it and how it is growing, the anticipation by epidemiologists, I said I wouldn't use much, but here is a bit. Here is the prognosis. Look at the orange. I want you to focus on the orange in the next 10 slides. This is growing. Here, by region of the world, Africa, Eastern Mediterranean, Southeast Asia, Western Pacific, Americas, Europe, you will see how the communicable diseases, Salmonella, E. coli are communicable, TB is communicable. They're coming back, we've got them here, but they're not nearly as big as they are in Africa. But look at how even in Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, even sub-Saharan Africa has got a problem of overconsumption, showing up in disease. And here, we have hundreds, thousands of such slides. Look at the rapidity of the trend in mean total cholesterol in Beijing, China. People aged, or males and females, 25 to 64, in just 15 years. This is not God-given. The trends in obesity in Brazil, as people know me, I was brought up in India as a child. I tend to look at India as an example. It's got the highest rate of diabetes, my home city of Bombay, now Mumbai. Here's Brazil. India, Brazil, China, you're talking about nearly half of humanity. These trends are just happening everywhere. Excuse me, I've gone back. Obesity is much in the news, and rightly so now. Look at these countries. Mexico, Brazil, Morocco, Egypt, South Africa, Thailand, so on. Growing. The percentage of BMI, body mass index, of over 30 is clinically obese. Okay, Thailand, look at that happening. BMI of over 25 is your overweight. This is in countries which have very little health care.
Here, in one slide, I'm now going to give you what I call a floor show. I just want you to observe how, in the United States, in a very small amount of time, the BMIs of the number of the population with BMIs over 20% having a BMI of above 30, that is clinically obese. Okay, now just watch this. I'm going to begin in 1985. This is the United States. I'm doing these in years. The classification is even having to be changed. It's awesome. And this is why President Bush, not known for his sympathies with the welfare state or thinking about the role of the state in benign way, other than bombing Iraqis or Afghanistanis, is now deeply worried. The bill, the externalized cost of diet-related disease, is now a major threat to the US economy. That bill is astonishing. This is official government US figures. Here in Europe, cardiovascular disease accounts for 1.5 million deaths. It's 42% of all deaths in Europe. Remember the picture I've been giving you that India, Brazil are now entering the terrain that we're now in. We are now in it, and we can't afford it. How is India going to cope with coronary bypass diseases? The United States spends more money on 100,000 stomach tuck operations every year than Vietnam, with 70 million consumers, has to spend on healthcare in its entirety. How is Vietnam going to be able to cope with this? So what we have, and this is why the productions paradigm is now useless, it is fit for the dustbin. And I speak as an ex-farmer. Frank didn't say that. It's because the basis on which we encourage farming was an assumption that we were dealing with hunger. We've still got hunger, actually, worldwide, but the overconsumption problems are now exceeding it. But we have both. The policy questions, therefore, turn to this. Have we got the wrong bodies? I don't, you know, say that lightly. The life sciences approach is saying, well, we can tweak the genes. We can tailor the food, we can tweak the genes. Or is marketing wrong? I think we can't do much about our biological legacy. We can do something about these things. The argument is, Chris and I have argued before, and I actually half agree with him, this is to some extent the problem of rising incomes. But it's also the problem of this. Yet these are British figures. Ready to drink soft drinks in just 25 years, grams per person per week. Barry Popkin, I sit on an FAO committee where we've reviewed the entire developing world, book that's going to come out next March. We've done 35 case studies covering three quarters of humanity. If there is one thing that is going to have to be reined in, it's soft drinks. Mintel very kindly sent me a report, which is a fabulous report, just came out a month and a half ago, looking at after-school children in Britain. The expenditure, this is a percentage of respondents saying, this is children, school-aged children, 7 to 16, that they eat after school, 60% are eating crisps on the way home. The good news is there's 27% saying they're eating fruit. The bad news is it's the fruit that their mothers usually, father sometimes, gave them to eat at lunch. I'm highlighting in order not to be accused of over-egging my pudding. Here are some figures. Look at the expenditure. This is after-school market. £3.4 billion on chop bars and countbars. Had an advertising spend of £91 million. This, in just 6 months of this year, you can't get more up to date than this. I did my best. Walker's Chris spent £11.25 million on advertising. I mean, those of you who believe in corporate social responsibility, I mean, you could say £1.2 million of advertising going on Walker's Chris might be a good thing. I personally think it's a disgrace.
and I think the celebrities should pull out of it. What we've got, in other words, is
in health, we're beginning to see the impact of the 20th century food revolution. Now, Yanni Gabriel and I wrote our unmanageable consumer book partly with food in mind, but thinking much bigger than that. Let's go back to the rhetoric. People like me, people like you, encounter the rhetoric that consumers are suffering. What does that mean in a consumer society? It's actually been translated into things you might or might not agree with, privatization, on the grounds that consumers can add value and seek value from things. At its most extreme, the consumer votes theory that says, why have government, turn everything into a value and you can buy it in the marketplace. Meanwhile, social scientists are arguing rather peripherally on the edge, actually it's more complex than this. Now, taking the Gabriel and Nine models, you can see there are very different models of what it is to be a consumer. Many, many books, market research has been brilliant at pulling out these sort of models, saying one moment we're looking for value for money, next moment we're looking for fun, next moment we're using it to seek and fix an identity, next moment we're complaining that we've been ripped off, next moment we're rebelling, next moment, as the National Consumer Council would wish we were more of, we're being citizens. Well, the truth is we're doing all of them. But the hard world of the food supply chain will essentially come down to saying it's centrality of price, or do they? We can go to the Food Standards Agency, which in its submission to the Curry Commission in 2001 said, factors influencing purchasing, this was unprompted, sorry, this is not them, this is their own their survey done in October 2001, said that consumers really buy food overwhelmingly on price, not on taste, quality, all of these things are piddling and peripheral. And the former chief executive of the FSA, certainly once in my presence in the public press, said that really these things, not these things didn't matter, but the sort of issues that campaigners worry about are peripheral and irrelevant. Third point, consumptions and what it is to be a consumer, I think, are really changing. Here is anyone who's familiar in geography with retailing will be familiar with this, the CACI, the CACI system of categories of consumption. Where am I up to? I'm about halfway. Here are some examples of how retail geographers, retail geographers categorize us in this way. You can sit down and work out in an area, I live in Wandsworth, you can do a demographic breakdown of Wandsworth according to this and then see how the profile of which particular supermarket will fit or not fit. It's very sophisticated. Meantime, actually the world has split. This is UNDP, United Nations Development Programme data, going back to the 1820s. Forgive the quality of this slide, I just wanted you to see the impact of it. The inequalities between the world's wealthiest 20% and the world's poorest 20% over broadly the last two centuries has grown. So we've got, if I just go back, you've got this immensely complex, very sophisticated, very, very subtle, fine-tuned approach to what consumers are, and some gross inequalities. How do we make sense of this? Partly, and I'm going to be semi-critical of my fellow social scientists here, I think social scientists in the last 20, 30 years have started wallowing in the complexity and lost touch with this enormous class reality. And I want to argue that the picture that I gave you earlier of overconsumption and underconsumption is essentially the beginnings of solid evidence worldwide and within society of the emergence of a new global class structure. We're seeing it, if you look at this, this is obesity and overweight by social class in Britain, class 1 to class 4. You can see among men a class gradient to people with a BMI, body mass index, over 30. The lower your class, the lower your income, the higher the chance of you being clinically obese. the class differences. I deliberately picked these, and I want to acknowledge Annie Anderson at Dundee, professor of food choice, nutrition and stuff there, for these figures she very kindly gave me. You can see the class disparities widening. Food is not, let us stress, the only factor in this, but it is one. If we look at fresh vegetable consumption, this is bang up to date over the last 25 years, you see the class divide again. People, that's me, over £655 a week. I'm the maroon, and if there's anyone here, less than £165 a week, look at the fish. Fish is always a very good indicator. We should be eating more fish. And Ed Mayo will say, no, we shouldn't. And I'm going to go into that in a minute. Look, in Scotland, I put this up for you, Deirdre. In Scotland, where Deirdre Hutton is from, the chair of the National Consumer Council, it's basically a disaster zone.
It is.
It is a disaster zone. I'll skip that. I've got Mr. Bush on my mind, so I thought I'd put this up. In the richest land, country that the world has ever seen, you have 23 million people food insecure without hunger. Think of that as a classification. Food insecure without hunger. And food insecure with hunger, 11 million. And the key thing is, this is the government, USDA, Economic Research Service. The numbers in the US are rising. Now, consumers are complex. What do they really want? This is a very standard position I'm going to give you. This is something that is milk and drink within the consumer movement, where I used to work for 10 years, still identify with. That's my bias. I'm happy to confess that. Actually, whereas the politicians talk about the need to service, indeed almost slavishly service, consumer sovereignty, actually in the consumer world there is a problem of consumer of choice overload. How can you possibly choose between 25,000 items? 10,000 new items come on to the food market in the European Union every year. And within 2 years, exactly 10% of them are surviving. And yet, it's about 25% known value items the consumer knows the price of. Remember, I'm asking you to think about that study poll from the Food Standards Agency that said consumers overwhelmingly choose food on price. But they only know 25 items. Now let's go to other work from the same data set, from the FSA. This is unprompted. Okay, there was the thing. Now, I'm sorry, my colour taste was terrible. We're painting our kitchen pink at the moment, so I did this in pink. Here is the price. Now, what consumers, so that's what consumers really buy on, according to the FSA and its data. Not criticizing the FSA. Now here, when consumers are prompted, actually, they say that price is not nearly as important as their family's health, taste, food safety, environment, animal welfare. Is it any wonder then policymakers say consumers don't know what they want? They say one thing, they do another thing. They can't even agree on what they're doing. And here is some other data from the FSA, from a different but comparable data set from theirs. I put this up to show you the change. The growth of concern about food issues affecting your eating habits, healthy eating has gone up by 4% from 2001 to 2002. 85% of people saying they're buying food by health. Of 77% of consumers who said they were very or fairly concerned about the way food is produced, mention was made of these. Actually, animal welfare has rocked right up in there, into the consciousness. Now, how do we make sense of this? Do we just say, well, they actually buy by price, but when talking to people like Tim Lang or Frank Trentman or BRMB, they'll start talking waffly, softy, touchy things. And this is, I'm a psychologist by training, this is the typical schizophrenia of the consumer. Is that how we explain it? Well, I found this very useful. This is from one of
the top 10 supermarket companies, in the top half of the top 10 in Britain. This is what they are now designing their food systems around. That as consumers get older and their income rises, hopefully, they move from a primary concern about food safety to ethics. This is the long-term scenario that they think consumers are moving. This is the model of consumer choice, one of the top three retailers in Britain thinks. It's not Tesco. Mrs. Tesco is down here. Here, from a different source, you can't even see these, but I just want you to feel the width. Here is the sort of tracking studies that the retailers do. These are for all a whole variety of different items and concerns. And what you see in almost all of them, November 2000, November 2001, November 2002, you see rising concern in all of them. Marine Stewardship Council, awareness of that has gone from nothing to 30%. That's purely because they began to ask questions then. But what is interesting is that companies, as opposed to the politicians, are actually tracking this iceberg emerging from the sea of other issues. Now you could say, well, that's just very good, soft, touchy-feely. Just to convince you, some of you may know this, this is a report from JP Morgan, who very kindly gave me the bank. They have started ranking companies for their exposure to the health problem. I ask you to focus on Cadbury. The chairman of Cadbury is the chairman of the Food and Drink Federation this year. Today, they've just launched a new cross-sectoral cartel of the British Retail Consortium, the National Farmers Union, the Food and Drink Federation, the Food Advertising Unit of the Advertising Association, and I can't remember which the other one was, a catering organization. They, JP Morgan said, are basically 88% exposed, this is financially exposed, to problems of health in their product range. Consumers, this is literally off, this was came out exactly 18 days ago, also from Morgan Stanley. Cadbury Schweppes, this is consumer perceptions of how exposed consumers think these companies are to health. Cadbury Schweppes here is getting dangerously close to the McDonald's and Yum brands. Yum brands you've probably never heard of, but it owns Kentucky Fried Chicken. So some complex, big macro finance is going on here, where nervousness in the hearts of the city is beginning to say the productionist model is running out of steam. How can we make sense of this? I think we have to make sense of it by seeing food as contested space. We have to understand not just the global emergence of a global consuming class structure, but the emergence of a global consuming, a baronial class structure feeding it. Crudely, this is how you can approach it. Instead of seeing the state as the hands-on, dirigiste, or genial, facilitating state that frames policy, we have to see food now as contested space between these three. I put civil society, that's all of us as consumers, but also because I'm going to make another point about the role of consumer organizations within it. These are figures of the explosion, anticipated explosion of the top 10 retailers in Europe, this remarkable growth 2000 to 2010 anticipated. Here, if you need to know, this is the world, breakdown of the top 20 retailers in the world. Walmart, Asda to you, turned over nearly $200 billion a year. This is bigger than the whole of Africa, by the way. The same concentration levels and giants of baronial class is emerging here in pharmaceuticals, here in fast foods, McDonald's. Everyone says it's getting into trouble. It's not.
And this, I think, is the single most important slide I'm showing. This is a study done by Capgemini. She's not a social scientist. And it is not them. Forgive the quality of it. I put it up because I wanted you to see that they too think what I'm going to show you is important. Europe has, this is a study of European consumers, 250 million consumers at the moment, 3.2 million farmers, 160,000 manufacturers, give or take 240,000, very big manufacturers, like Chris's old one, but only 110 buying desks. 110 buying desks mediate between the 250,000 million consumers and the 3.2 million farmers. And it was them that put power there. Not me, but they're right. Bill Vawley, the Institute, International Institute of Environmental Development, has just done a study, has come out with the UK Food Group, looking at the coffee, taking the same Jan Peter Grieving's bottleneck argument, and showing how the same thing applies in coffee, the same thing applies in soybeans, the same thing applies in bananas. You don't even need to see the figures, I'll give you them if you want. Now, why does this matter? This is my point for Peter Jackson. It matters because this geospatial change is accompanying health costs and environmental costs. And if you don't know the name of Mr. Derek Wanless, you need to, former head of the National Westminster Bank. The Chancellor asked him to review the future of healthcare in Britain, and he said, we can't afford to go on like this. And so the Chancellor has asked him to do Wanless 2 to look at it. In other words, this is live policy, where it matters. I'm not going to go into this, but I want to remind you that I focused on health. We could equally health focus on environment. Just to illustrate the point, in 1920, the average waste bucket, a rubbish bin in London, was 63% dust and flinders, dust and cinders. I can't read my own writing. Now, it's dust and cinders has gone to next to nothing. But look at where the food supply chain is now contributing its waste. Vegetable matter, 20% of rubbish bins is vegetable matter. The emissions issue, food miles. I'm partial to the argument of food miles because I invented it. But I did it to try and grasp the enormity of the way in which we buy by price, do we? But we don't see where the food's coming from. This is evidence from a study just done from the department for the Department of Transport by Transport 2000. The emissions associated with food, associated with climate change, are astonishing. When we buy fruit, nutritionists say eat fruit, but most of the fruit is coming long distance. These are calculations slightly out of date. We're using other people's land to grow apples. We have 2,000 varieties of apples in the British apple collection. We sell 3 in the vast majority of this country. It's crazy. Fish, I said fish. Nutritionists say fish. We've just been doing a review of all the guidelines of nutrition for the whole world. Every country, every single one says eat fish. There is not an environmental study of fish in the seas that doesn't say we've got to consume less. Indeed, probably not at all. Now, I'm beginning to end. I want to argue, I hope I'm not going to offend some of my friends, the relative powerlessness of consumer organizations. I want to just remind you of the enormity of the ad spend. Consumer organizations are in the business of trying to inform consumers to the efficiencies of markets operate. The reality is it is totally skewed. The average American child by the age of 16 sees something like 30,000 advertisements a year. Here, £500 million a year is spent. This is just the top 10 brands in Britain. Here is the ad spend. Coca-Cola, your friend and mine, put Walker's Chris. In 2001, 2002, these are Nielsen figures, by the way. This is an immense amount of money being spent to try and shape our tastes. I'll skip that. Now let's contrast consumer organizations' budgets. The Consumers Association is what we call a PINGA, a public interest non-governmental organization. It's not government funded. It has exactly four staff working on food matters. It spends, in its total budget, £250,000 a year, of which nutrition is exactly £35,000. They gave me these figures. These are absolutely hot. National Consumer Council, it's a government funded, 80%, non-governmental organization. It has exactly two staff working on food, roughly. A percentage of its revenue. The Consumers International, which has 271 organizations worldwide, has exactly six people working on food. Its total food budget for consumers worldwide is 570,000. Sustain, that I chair, has 10 people. We're way the biggest in terms of food. And the budget of exactly 510. The National Heart Forum has seven, only one person working on nutrition, 100,000 a year. This is peanuts, is my point. You could say the state is now acting for the consumer. The Department of Health spends £3 million on nutrition. It has 16.8 people working on food. The Food Standards Agency, in theory, everyone is working. It's actually 600 people working for the FSA. I put query because I don't think everyone is working on nutrition. I'm going to give you a figure. The Health Development Agency spends exactly £500,000 and has five full-time workers. Here's the FSA's budget. I put this up for Jackie Webster. Nutrition and diet, that's 800,000 a year. Foodborne illness, spending way over twice that. It's why I got sent up out of a moral panic about food safety, not without reason. I backed it. But nutrition and those issues are barely being treated seriously. Okay, now let's conclude. Where is policy going? Where is the food supply chain going? Where are consumers going? I am arguing that a new architecture is emerging, new dimensions are emerging, with which we in social science must start exploring. Some of it are these sort of things. The old goal of food policy under the productionist paradigm is this. This has been crude, but broadly true. To raise output, increase efficiency, and raise productivity by capital and labor. Perceived problems, real problems, were those on the right. The new goals are actually these. We need to reduce overconsumption because of the nutrition transition. We need to make consumption equitable because of these gross inequalities within and between societies. We need to make it sustainable. We need to reinvigorate food culture because of commercially warped information. This is unacceptable. The good news is government now, after 15 years of pressure from some of us, is now beginning to realize it cannot afford to go on allowing the framing, I would say warping, of consumer culture. And I think this is the difficult one. I think we need to get a market economy again, because we haven't got that. We've got an oligopolistic one. We've got massive concentration and oligopolies. Last three slides. I put these for Frank. I could hear Frank saying, try and talk something about consumers and culture. That's what the program is called. In case you think I've forgotten. I try to address what I think the ecological paradigm would come up with. It would come up with things something like this. We need to factor in these as new cultural rules. We need to get biodiversity into the field and then to the plate. I could have given you a whole lecture about the collapse of biodiversity. that I thought that would not be seen as a consumerist issue.
It is a consumerist issue.
The physiology of the new ecological nutrition, people like Mark Valquist in Australia and others, are arguing that the physiology laid down a million years ago requires us to eat biodiversely. Now, you can get biodiversity by walking down the supermarket shelf, of course, but it comes from monoculture on the land. We need to think about nutrition, not by long-distance apples that are expending more energy than they give us. It's an easy point to make about an apple, I know, but it's a nonsense. This is the eco-nutrition argument, that we need to start eating a range of foods between 25 and 35 species a week. I set my students this as an exercise. They say after 3 days, 20.
Okay, day four.
Eat according to proximity. New rules. Drink water, not soft drinks. We should be banning soft drinks from schools. Four supporters? We should be banning. When these hundreds of millions of pounds are spent to warp physiology, this is unacceptable. I've done.